So the subject of my talk is the free software movement and the development of the GNU operating system. But really, the subject is a social and political and ethical subject. What should the rules be for using software and computers? Now, most of the time when people consider that question, they work for software companies, and they address the question in a self-serving way. They ask, what rules can we impose on other people to make them pay us a lot of money? And I'm sure you've heard many times the answer that they get. Well, I had the good fortune in the 1970s to be part of a community of programmers who shared software. And because of that experience, I was led to think about this question from a different direction. And so I asked, what kinds of rules make for a good society for the members of society? Make for a society that's good to live in? And so I reached a completely different answer. Let me say a little bit about what life in that community was like. It included programmers at the best universities. Even sometimes programmers at computer companies participated. And it was normal in our community that if you wrote a program, you'd share it. That was our way of life. The lab where I worked, the Artificial Intelligence Lab at MIT, was perhaps the deepest part of this community, because there, all the software we used was the community software. We had an entire operating system, the incompatible time-sharing system. I don't want to give publicity to companies. Just drink the soda. So, I don't want the brand name in a photograph. So we were using exclusively software that we could freely share. At most of the other labs, they had some proprietary operating system, and they used community software on top of that. But we didn't have a proprietary operating system. The incompatible time-sharing system was written by hackers for hackers, and I was very glad to be hired to join the team that developed it. So in this community, when you walked past another hacker's screen, if you saw something unusual, you'd say, hey, what is that? And he would say, oh, that's the new FUBAR program, which we just got from Stanford. And it's in the FUBAR directory. So in that directory, you'd find the executable that you could run, but also the source codes. You could study it and see how the people at Stanford, the hackers at Stanford, solve those problems. And then in running the program, you'd probably run into bugs, and you might have ideas for how to improve it. So you could go to the source code and fix the bugs, add new features, make whatever changes were necessary. You could even cut out a piece of the program and put it in some other program you were writing, which we called cannibalizing the old program, which was a joke because cutting a piece out of a program doesn't destroy the program. You don't have to kill it and cook it to eat part of it. Well, I guess theoretically speaking, you wouldn't have to do that to a human being either, but you get the point. So you could use the program not just by running it, but in all the various ways it could be useful. The software in our community was part of human knowledge. It was available to everyone to be used in all the useful ways. And because of that, I was able to feel that I was working to advance human knowledge. I was on humanity's team. I was not working for one group against other groups. And why bother doing that? It's not important. So, I felt very good about belonging to this community. I felt good about the work I was doing. But then eventually we got a taste of what life was like for most computer users, the ones who were not part of a cooperating community like ours. That happened when Xerox gave MIT a laser printer. Now, this was a very nice gift. It was the first time anybody outside Xerox had a laser printer. This was actually the first generation laser printer, really an office copier modified with a laser attachment to turn it into a printer. And it was very fast. It printed a page a second. It had high resolution. Straight lines came out sharp and straight. But it had a problem. It frequently got a paper jam. Now, as an office copier, there would have been somebody around to fix the jam. But as a printer, it was off by itself, and it often stayed jammed for a long time. Well, when we saw that that was happening, we knew what to do about that kind of problem. Because our previous printer, which was slow and low resolution and tended to make vertical lines a bit wavy, also got paper jams frequently. And since we couldn't make the printer itself any better, we added features to the software that ran the printer to compensate for the problems. For instance, every time a file finished printing, the system displayed a message for the user who printed it directly on the screen saying, "Your file foo has been printed." So you had to wait because the printer was slow, but you didn't have to wait extra just because you didn't know when your output was done. And there was another feature which I recall adding myself, which was every time the printer got in trouble, the system would display a message for all of the users currently waiting for printing, saying, "The printer is in trouble, go fix it." Now, if you got that message, you would realize that only a few people were going to get that message. So you were not going to sit there figuring someone else would fix the problem. Oh, no, you would go immediately to the printer and fix it. So the printer still got paper jams. But a minute later, there would be two or three users coming, and one of them at least would know how to fix the problem and would teach the others. So, in effect, we treated the user as part of the system, and we added end-to-end feedback, and we got reliable operation for the system as a whole, even though the printer component was still unreliable. After all, that's what feedback is for. But so of course, we thought of doing the same thing with the new printer, but there we ran into a stone wall. You see, we were able to add those features for the old printer because it was controlled by free software, you know, the software of the community. We had the source code. We could make changes limited only by our ability as programmers. But the new laser printer was controlled by proprietary software running on a proprietary Xerox mini computer. And we didn't have the source code, and so we were completely helpless. We were prisoners of our software. And so using that printer was constantly frustrating. You type the command to print a file, and then, of course, you go back to work. And a while later, you notice the time. Oh, it's been half an hour, I think. Well, not long enough. Experience shows half an hour is not long enough to wait. So you go back to work. And then you see, oh, it's been an hour, and I think I need it now, so I better go check. So you walk upstairs to the printer, and you see it's been jammed the whole time. So you fix the jam, and you go back to work. And then a while later you notice the time. Oh, it's been half an hour. Maybe it's printed now. So you go back to the printer and you see it printed 200 pages of other people's stuff, which was just 3 minutes for that fast printer, and then jammed again. And that had been sitting there for most of the half hour. So at that point you say, I'm going to stand here and fix this damn thing every time it jams until I get my output. Constantly frustrating, but even more frustrating to realize that somebody else, that we could have solved the problem, more or less, and somebody else was deliberately standing in our way by not letting us have the source code. Now, the people at Xerox could have fixed this for us, but I wouldn't say they had an obligation to do programming work for us. They had given us a rare and expensive gift. That's enough. I couldn't say they owed it to us to do work for us as well. But they shouldn't have stood in our way. They should have let us do the work. Then I heard that somebody at Carnegie Mellon had a copy of that source code. Eventually, I was visiting there, so I went to his office, and I said, hi, I'm from MIT. Can I have a copy of the printer software source code? And he said, no, I promised not to give you a copy. I was so stunned and angry that I couldn't see how to express my anger and do justice to it. All I could think of was to walk out of his office without a word. But I thought about it a lot afterwards. See, this was very bad for us at the Artificial Intelligence Lab because we never got a copy of that source code. We were never able to fix the problem. And the printer remained frustrating to use for all the years we kept using it. But in a paradoxical way, it was very good for me because it taught me an important lesson. Important because most programmers don't learn it. You see, he had promised to refuse to help us, his colleagues at MIT. He had effectively promised to deny us his cooperation if we needed it. But he didn't just do that to us. Chances are he did it to you too. And I'd say it's most likely that he did it to you too. And chances are he did it to you as well. In fact, he probably did it to most of the people in this room. The exceptions mainly being whoever wasn't born yet at the time, because that was 1980 or so. Because, in fact, he had promised to refuse his help to just about everybody in the entire world. He had signed a non-disclosure agreement. This was my first direct encounter with a non-disclosure agreement. And the lesson it taught me, and I was the victim. I and my whole lab were the victims. And the lesson it taught me was that non-disclosure agreements have victims. They're not innocent. They're not harmless. They're really hurting somebody. Most programmers first encounter a non-disclosure agreement when they're invited to sign one. And there's always some sort of temptation, some goodie that they're going to get if they sign. So they make up excuses to ignore the ethical issue of whether they're doing something wrong. They say to themselves, he'll never get a copy anyway, so what difference does it make if I join the conspiracy to deprive him? They say, this is the way it's always done. How could I possibly go against this? They say, if I don't do this, somebody else will. Various excuses to gag their consciences. But the first time somebody invited me to sign a non-disclosure agreement, my conscience was already sensitized to this issue. I remembered how angry I was when somebody else did that to me and to my whole lab as well. I could not turn around and do the same thing to other innocent people. I knew it was wrong. So I said, thank you very much for offering me this nice software package, but I cannot accept it in good conscience on the conditions that you have set. So I'm going to do without it. Thank you very much. And so I have never knowingly signed a non-disclosure agreement for generally useful technical information, such as software. Now, there are other kinds of information which raise different issues. For instance, there's personal information. Totally different issue. If you ask me if you could talk with me about what's happening between you and your girlfriend and would I please not tell anybody, that I could agree to, because that's not generally useful technical information. At least it probably isn't. Now I could imagine that maybe you would disclose to me a marvelous new sex technique, and I would then feel a moral duty to pass that on of humanity so that everyone could use it. But if you were just going to tell me about the usual soap opera stuff, you know, who hurt whose feelings, how, and what that person did in return, and all those difficulties, those details of your life, those are not something that other people need to know in order to live their lives better. So it's okay for me to keep that private for you. But when it comes to the stuff of science and technology, this generally useful technical information, the mission of these fields is to develop this information for humanity. If we withhold it from humanity, we are betraying the mission of our fields. And that, I concluded, I must not do.